Welcome to Access Utah. In the second half of the program, coming up in about 30 minutes, we'll help you with your taxes, especially if you haven't gotten to them yet and you need to get to them soon. The deadline is April 17th, so you have a couple of extra days. We'll be talking with a couple of representatives from the IRS, spokesman Bill Brunson and Criminal Division Special Agent Tom Marker. Talk about avoiding tax scams, a fresh start program, and finding a tax preparer that you can trust. In this part of the program, we're talking higher education in a time when Utah's eight public campuses have experienced explosive growth. That's been cooling off a bit, but still growing, and declining appropriations from the legislature and a declining economy. We're going to take a look at the state of higher education. Our guest is Utah State University President Stan Albrecht. President Albrecht, thanks. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Appreciate you coming in today. So I mentioned that that growth, it's been tailing off, I think 8% down to 5%, down to 1.6%, but that has come at a time of declining appropriations. How do you think higher ed fared in this past legislative session?
Well, this was somewhat of a unique experience after several years of budget cutting to go into a session where we weren't spending all of our time trying to overcome the challenges of another budget cut. We went through six rounds of budget cutting, $25.2 million out of our budget over about a three and a half year period. And so even though this is not a session that you do backflips down the hall over because of the availability of a lot of new money, at least we weren't budget cutting and some good things happened. So we feel good about that.
So you met your goals. I guess I should ask you, what were your goals going into the session?
Well, going into the session, as you will recall, when the governor released his pre-session budget, it included some compensation for state employees, but it not included those of us working in higher education. And so one of our first goals going into the session was to make sure that higher ed employees are treated as are other state employees on the compensation front. And so that turned rather quickly. I think the governor realized that he needed to support that. He did. Legislative leadership supported it. And so the compensation issue was addressed. Again, it's not a big number, but after years of nothing, at least it's now starting to move in the right direction. So we feel good about that. That was our primary goal. And then we focused on a number of mission-based things and regional campus initiatives that we can talk about as we go along. Mm-hmm.
What about the growth? As of last year, I'm reading an article from the Salt Lake Tribune, it had tailed off a little bit. I'm not sure what enrollment was this year.
Well, tailed off a bit, but we have continued growing on the Logan campus. We've continued growing in an even more rapid way at our regional campuses. And so we now have a number of semesters of double-digit growth at our regional campuses. We really anticipate that is going to continue. We're projecting, given the projected high school graduation rates and some of the other things going on in the state, we're projecting that we will probably be looking at something like a 3 to 3.5% growth rate over the next number of years, combining regional campuses and the Logan campus.
Mm. Now that, of course, puts pressure on appropriations. Hopefully we have an increasing economy. Do you reach a point where some students are left out who would like to come to universities who can't?
Well, you know what's happening in California and some other states, and we hope that future is not our future. But let me just comment very briefly on that. Over the last decade, we have seen a really dramatic shift in terms of how these places are being funded. 10 years ago, for example, for every dollar of tuition we raised, we received $3.50 in state appropriations. Last year, for every dollar of tuition we raised, we received $1.30 in state appropriations. And so over a decade, that's really a dramatic shift. So what, of course, has happened is we've seen a move away from public funding for these public institutions to other sources of funding, some combination of tuition and philanthropy, our capital campaign, of course, affecting that, our research success, of course, affecting that, but a pretty dramatic shift. Now, over that period of time until the last 2 years, even with the reduction in state support, the combination of state appropriation and tuition revenue has stayed ahead of FTE growth. These last 2 years, that has not happened. And so what we have now is really something that is not sustainable. And we do face a future where some difficult decisions will have to be made unless that pattern can be changed.
Mm-hmm. Now, the private fundraising, apart from the legislative funding. That seems to have become, as you mentioned, a bigger part of the pie. That will only increase, I suspect.
It has to increase. As you know, the privates have done this for many years. The publics have gotten into this more recently, and in Utah State's case, even more recently. We're in our first comprehensive campaign, set a goal of $200 million and then increased that to $400 million. We will finish our campaign and have an event celebrating the success of the campaign in October when we have our old main event. And it's been huge for us. And when you get back to the student funding side of this, we now have something over 230 new scholarship endowments that have been created over the course of the campaign. And so what you see, again, is replacing state dollars in other ways, and this is one of the ways that that is occurring.
Hmm. There have in the past been turf wars between institutions that have, reached the press. I don't know where the state of that is. Is the roadmap clear and everybody's on board?
Well, I think we had a very different session in another way. It wasn't just where the budget was, but this session, the presidents of the eight institutions decided that we needed to work very closely together. And so one day a week, we were all there together meeting with leadership, with others, talking about the importance of funding for higher education, talking about the importance of mission-based initiatives, talking about the importance of compensation. And so we felt that common face among the eight presidents was important in terms of where we were needing to go. And so that was a model that occurs during a time when there will be a change in the office of the commissioner, that occurred during a time when there will be change in leadership at the State Board of Regents. And so we felt that it was important for the presidents to step up together. And I think it worked. I think it worked nicely for us.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, your vision for the future of higher education in general. Preface this by a conversation I had recently with a friend who is getting a graduate degree. He chose Western Governors University because of flexibility. He was planning perhaps moving, and that way he could pick up classes wherever he went. I know Indiana's governor, Mitch Daniels, has been pushing Western Governor University. Distance Ed here seems like it's growing leaps and bounds ahead of the main campus. Is that the future?
Well, Western Governors University serves a unique kind of student, and I don't in any way argue with that. But they really do not target, nor do they have interest in serving the 18-year-old high school graduate. That is not part of their mission. That remains our mission. But in addition, there was a book published this last year by Clayton Christensen called The Innovative University, and it really talked about how do these institutions that we love and care about stay ahead in a changing way of delivering education. And we feel like we have done that. If you look, for example, at online education, if you look at the courses that we offer through interactive video conferencing, in many ways, we're not only keeping up with technology, but we're defining technology. And so as a result of that, we now have 5,000 students that take USU courses through interactive video conferencing. That obviously will be a part of our future. We have students in all 50 states working on USU degrees. We have students in 50 foreign countries working on USU degrees. So part of our future. But it doesn't take away the importance of what we do at the mothership with bringing students here and giving them the quality of education that comes through being in a classroom with peers. Much of the educational experience, of course, comes from interaction with peers. And so we do both, and I think we do both very well.
There is quite impressive growth in the distance education.
There is.
I think nationwide, including here in Utah.
Yeah, and again, that's where if you combine regional campuses and distance education, that is where our most rapid growth is occurring. But again, we serve if you look at the demographics of the students that we serve, as you would expect, they're older. A higher percentage of them are female. 62% of the students we serve through those means are female. Our breakdown on campus is about 50-50. And so it reaches a demographic that otherwise would be maybe denied the opportunity for a higher education experience. So needs to be very much part of what we do.
So the more traditional student coming up to high school, that will remain a Logan experience or whatever university you picked?
Yeah, we still, again, as most of us and some of us are getting old enough, it's hard to reflect back that long ago. But as we reflect back on the experience, it's the advantage we have as Utah State University is providing a full residential experience for our students. And so that involves a high-quality education. But it also involves all of the other things that a young person that age is able to experience as a student at Utah State University.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, our guest in this half of the program is Utah State University President Stan Albrecht. We're talking about higher education, obviously, and Utah State University. You're welcome to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. Or you can email us your question at upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. The phone number, once again, toll-free, 1-800-826-1495. This is the 150th anniversary year of the Morrill Act. And if you don't know what the Morrill Act is, you probably have heard of land-grant institutions. And I just wanted to read briefly. This is from USU Magazine, by the way. Justin Morrill from Vermont in 1862, he talked about scatter broadcasting the knowledge which will prove useful in building up a great nation. His vision was to bring resources of a university to more and more, in fact, all students who wanted to have that education. That's the land-grant vision, and I'm guessing you view that as very important for Utah State University.
It's a critical part of who we are and what we do. We're celebrating that 150th anniversary. We started at our Founders Day event last month in March. We have created traveling exhibits in the library. They will go to all of our 29 counties. We will include lectures on the history of the Morrill Act. Again, changed the face of education dramatically. To that point, education was largely private and very expensive, and so it was limited basically to the children of the upper classes. And so the Morrill Act basically created the access opportunity for, as some of the language says, the children of the toiling classes. And so that's part of our history. We're proud of it. It's very much part of our mission.
Mm. And that accessibility factor that, I guess, remains part of the mission of any land-grant institution?
Indeed, it does. The initial set of institutions that were made possible by the original Morrill Act in 1862 was then extended in 1890 with the creation of the traditional black colleges and universities, the black land grants. And so, again, those are primarily in the southern states, but extended that concept of access and opportunity in another important way. And then more recently, Hispanic land grants, Native American land grants have been added to the portfolio. And so it continues to be an important part of the vision of access in America.
Mm. Now, with rising tuition, and that seems to be just a fact of life, even as we acknowledge that education is highly subsidized, is that going to compete with that vision?
Well, it's one of the challenges we face. In Utah, we have one of the lowest rates of state-supported need-based aid of any state in the United States. And so, again, as our demographics change, as we're dealing with growth of minority underserved populations, first generation students, how do we create opportunities for them in the face of increasing cost, rising tuition? And so we just have to continue to give more attention to the need-based aid concept. We have to give more attention to the kinds of scholarships like our Aggie Promise scholarship that is really designed to help young people who are prepared for Utah State education but otherwise could not afford it. And so we really are giving a lot of attention through our campaign to increasing our ability to address the issue you're raising.
Mm. The economy, of course, has a big effect, not only through decreasing appropriations. I would imagine it affects fundraising as well in a down economy, but also what students face when they leave university. And there's been some worry on the part of legislators that perhaps we're not preparing students directly enough for jobs in this economy. What's your response to that?
Well, again, if you go back to the broader mission of these institutions, I would argue as strongly as I can argue that while certainly we ought to be preparing our students for careers and jobs and lives ahead of them, that the experience of a college education extends much beyond that and affects quality of life, affects the other kinds of things that they will do with their lives, the service they will give to their communities, family life, other kinds of things. So we certainly do spend a lot of time worrying about the correlation between the experience here and life and career opportunities. While at the same time saying that a broad liberal arts education is still of great value and will always be of great value, particularly in a global economy where they need to understand languages and cultures and histories and other sorts of things. So the great thing about Utah State University is that we feel that we bring those two together in a very nice way.
Hmm. Do you find that there's a resistance to that argument, which I'm sure is understood, felt by many, but do you find resistance to that argument at the legislature?
Yes, somewhat. We didn't hear nearly as much talk this year as we did a few months ago about degrees to nowhere. That was received a lot of media attention, and we think we were successful in blunting that argument by providing data on where students go who get those, quote, degrees to nowhere, their preparation to move into successful and productive careers. The data were good. And so, you know, again, that's not an issue that was as prevalent. I think we also at Utah State offset that a little bit by the national argument has been that tuition is going up, students are accumulating lots of debt, then they're going out and don't have jobs. Our students graduate with the lowest average debt of any institution in the United States. And so we feel that we have a combination of a great educational experience. Sometimes our students take a little bit longer, but they do it because they don't want that debt. And so they're going out not so likely to be burdened by that as they move into the job market and into a career.
I know institutions of higher learning do worry about time to graduation.
Sure.
But you're saying if you take a little longer time and come out with less debt, that's okay with you.
You know, we spent a lot of time in this legislative session talking about that, and I think in many ways we changed the nature of that conversation. For example, and let me just share this with you briefly, we have a six-year graduation rate of 43%, and you could look at that and say, wow, you're failing. But if we take that 43% graduation rate and combine it with students who are still here working on degrees, again, because they're working, many of them are married, some have children, takes a little bit longer to get through. You combine that, we're now able to track students who go somewhere else. We couldn't do that until the last couple of years, who get degrees someplace else, either a baccalaureate or an associate degree. And then we have students that are still working on degrees at other institutions. And when you begin to combine all of that, we end up with what we call a 93% success rate rather than a 43% graduation rate. And we think the 93% success rate is far more descriptive of what's really happening with students who come to Utah State University. That changes the conversation.
A college degree, I believe, still is the gold standard, isn't it? If you compare, you know, high school diploma versus a baccalaureate degree, the lifetime earnings are, there's a big disparity there.
Yeah, I read a piece a couple of days ago, I think it was in The Atlantic, that said, what is more costly than going to college? And the answer was not going to college. And so when you look at things like lifetime earnings and other things, it's still the greatest investment that one can make.
Hmm. So as university president, I believe inherently you would be worried about K-12 and what kinds of students, how students are being prepared. I wonder if that's going up or going down.
I have the opportunity of serving on the Governor's Excellence in Education Commission, and much of the conversation of that commission has been on K-12 preparation, so that again students are ready for a college experience once they complete K-12. That is receiving a great deal of attention. The collaboration between institutions of higher education and public schools, I think, is maybe better than it's ever been. We're now interviewing candidates to serve as director of a new STEM center at Utah State University, and part of the mission of that science, technology, education, math, engineering math center will be to really reach out to the public schools so that students are better prepared as they come to Utah State University. So that's getting a lot of attention, and I think is moving in a much more positive way.
Hmm. Do you think students are coming in well prepared?
That is always a challenge. Again, if you look at students coming to Utah State University, in large part, yes. But we always hope that they might be a little bit better prepared, particularly in the science disciplines, English and math. And so, again, we need to recognize that part of that is our responsibility. We're training the teachers that are going into public schools to teach them, and that's part of the equation.
Mm-hmm. What would you tell students coming or their parents in terms of preparation?
Well, make sure one takes a good math science curriculum, a good English curriculum, and continue that through the completion of the high school experience. Don't take that last year off and sort of coast.
Mm-hmm.
Take a calculus class or another physics class or whatever else. I think that preparation will then serve them well as they come to the university.
We're talking with Utah State University President Stan Albrecht in this part of the program. Coming up, we'll be talking with representatives from the IRS. Your tax day is April 17th. If you haven't got on that, we'll have some tips for you. The number is 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. President Albrecht, I believe the higher education system has a goal by 2020 of 66% of Utahns with a college degree, and right now we're hovering around 40%. Do you think that's doable?
The goal is really something that came from the governor's Excellence in Education Commission rather than directly from higher education. And the focus is not just on baccalaureate degrees, but on some form of credentialing. And so that obviously engages the community colleges with their associate degrees. It engages the UCAT system with more technologically oriented degrees. And so it has to be a combination of what we do at traditional higher education institutions as well as what we do at these other kinds of places. It's a steep hill for us to climb. It's going to be a major challenge. I think it's an appropriate goal. The challenge is compounded by the changing demographics of those who are going through a public education system. And so it's going to take a pretty massive effort on the part of everyone to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. What about initiatives that you're especially excited about here at Utah State University?
Well, again, let me just mention quickly a couple of things coming out of the legislative session. We received some mission-based funding that will help us with we're working very hard on really extending and making far more robust our summer school offering. I would like for us eventually to move to a true trimester system. Our greatest assets at Utah State University are our faculty and our physical plant. And we underutilize those two great assets during the summertime. And so we were able to get some funding that will help us to really begin a process over the next 3 years that will move all of our departments to a much more robust summer offering. I'm excited about that. We received some funding in this legislative session to take the nursing program, the RN program that we inherit as a result of CEU becoming a part of the USU system, that allows us to take the RN program to all of our regional campuses to train young people who will do internships and then stay and work in rural hospitals where there's a great need for that. So we're excited about that. There are just a number of things like that that are going on right now.
Very good. We're out of time for this half hour. Utah State University President Stan Albrecht has been our guest. Thank you so much.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Coming up following a break, we'll talk with representatives of the IRS, get you prepared for tax day, which you have a couple of extra days. April 17th is the day this year. That's coming up.
This is Contemporary Western Women. I'm Elaine Thatcher. Julie Jensen is a playwright living in Salt Lake City. Her plays have been produced all over the United States and in London. For many years, she taught college classes in playwriting. But she didn't always expect to be writing plays.
I was an actress, And I was auditioning for Shakespeare Festival in Santa Cruz. And, you know, it was hard. I mean, being an actor, is like, God, it's so hard. So I said to myself, okay, if I don't get in this, if I don't get in this festival, I'm going to quit this. It's stupid. I don't like it. I hate the auditions. And I'm not doing this anymore. And so, of course, I auditioned and I didn't get in. And then the great relief when I realized, oh, then I'm going to write plays, aren't I? And the answer was, of course, yes. And then I realized that nobody's standing in your way saying, no, you can't do that now. You didn't get in. If you wanted to write your play, you could write the play. They didn't have to do it, but you could write it. So they weren't stopping you from practicing your craft. And that seemed to me a gift, which it is.
Julie grew up in Beaver, Utah, and many of her plays reflect the cultural milieu of rural Utah. Her play, Two-Headed, is about the Mountain Meadows Massacre that took place on September 11, 1857. The massacre was a forbidden topic in her family, largely because she had an ancestor who was involved in the crime.
The metaphor was, okay, I mean, I put the two-headed calf in there later because I named it because I didn't care if you actually got this or not, but how it feels to be hauling around a secret. How it feels to be two things, to know something and not know things, to know something and not talk about them. So that's what it meant. And I think we all have experience being two-headed. It's just about what. Mm-hmm. And so that was the reason that it was named that. I had always been interested. My family was part of it, so it was one of those things you didn't speak of, and we talked about it. And you couldn't get Juanita Brooks's book, and my father had a copy of it, and he kind of shuttled it around the family, and they would kind of sit in the back room and talk about it. So it had this aura about it. The massacre always did have this weird aura.
In the play Two-Headed, the characters possess items that you later learn came from the massacred immigrants.
I was talking to my sister one day, and I said, you know what the access to that story is the stuff. It's the stuff that they got, you know, that they would have things. They would have weird stuff, and that would be the way into the story. And then as soon as I thought that up, I was done, because I could imagine, oh, of course, kids. And then what happens, kids who saw it or heard about it or voodoo, like me. It had an ominous feel about it. And then as soon as I knew that my access was those camisoles, in that case, it came easily after that.
Contemporary Western Women is a project of Utah State University's Center for Women and Gender and Utah Public Radio. We focus on women in the Rocky Mountain region and their stories of strength, hope, and humor in all aspects of life. If you have a story to share or know someone who does, please visit the Contemporary Western Women link at upr.org or call 1-800-826-1495. I'm Elaine Thatcher.
And the Utah State University Theater Arts Department will present the play Two-Headed, a two-character play depicting 40 years in the lives of two 19th-century Mormon women in Utah. Production dates are April 16th through the 21st, with a 7:30 p.m. curtain call in the Morgan Theater, located in the Chase Fine Arts Center on the USU Logan campus.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
April 15th, the deadline for taxes is approaching, and we thought it a good time to sit down with a couple people from the IRS. Bill Brunson is a spokesperson for the IRS. We've had him on our air several times. Thanks for coming back.
Tom, it's always a pleasure to be here.
And you, I think you represent several areas, western states.
Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah.
All right.
Yeah.
And with us as well is Ron Marker, who's a special agent in the criminal division of IRS. Is that correct?
That's right.
So with you, we're going to talk about some tax scams and how to protect ourselves and some other things. I'll start with Bill Brunson. What are the things, if we haven't filed our taxes, and hopefully many people have, I guess the first thing would be selecting a tax preparer,
right,
or not, to do it yourself. Yeah. But what are some of the things to think about?
Well, Tom, I'm going to step back in time just a second. It's Tuesday, April 17th. It's the due date this year.
We've got some extra time.
Yeah, two extra days to file and pay on that return for the 2011 year that you file in 2012. And the reason why is because Sunday, the 15th, is a non-business day, so it gets pushed forward to the 16th. But the 16th is also a date that is recognized in the District of Columbia. It's Emancipation Day. So that is a federal holiday, so one more day forward. So people have two more days this year. Now, selecting a tax preparer, approximately 65% of all Utahns who will file a return will go to a paid preparer. So when you do that sort of an item, you want to be careful. You want to choose one that will be around after the filing season in case you get a letter from the Internal Revenue Service or would be there to answer any questions that may come up. You want to choose one that has continual professional education. They've gone back to the schoolhouse, learned about the new tax law, and they can explain it to you as to how it applies to your specific facts and circumstances so that when you see that return and it's all compiled and you have a question about a particular line, they should be able to address that very clearly. Your good tax preparer will willingly sign the tax return, and that's required by law. And they will also, this year as well as last year, have obtained a number from the Internal Revenue Service, a preparer tax identification number, that they can show to you. Your bad tax preparer, on the other hand, is not going to be there after the filing season. They're going to say to you, I can get you a very large refund without working any numbers through the forms. How would they know at that point? They wouldn't. Or they're going to say, I will base my fees on a percentage of the refund that I can get back to you. Fees should be based on services rendered, not on a percentage. And it is an ethical violation of Circular 230, which is a guide for tax preparers, if you base your fees on the percentage of a refund. So that's a big no-no. Word of mouth is another way to find out about a tax preparer. You can go to the Better Business Bureau and see if that preparer that you're planning on going to has any issues in the local community. If they are an enrolled person, such as an actuarialist, a tax law accountant, an enrolled agent, or a certified public accountant, you can go to their societal bodies and check and see if they are in good standing. So CPAs would have the State Accountancy Board. Tax attorneys would have the State Bar Association. Enrolled agents, you could contact the Internal Revenue Service and we could say, yeah, they're a good one, or no, there's been some issues, that sort of thing. So there are things that stand out, and you need to make a good decision here because you're the ultimate responsible person for the information on that return. And you never want to sign a blank return, nor do you want to sign a return without reviewing it. And you can always call the IRS, and we'd be able to provide that information to you again. You can log on irs.gov, or you can call us on our toll-free line, 1-800-829-1040, and that's Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. local time.
Mm-hmm. So part of this is, if you turn it over to a tax preparer, maybe you've done that because you don't understand all the ins and outs, but you still need to review it. But what maybe to look for it? Are there any red flags?
Well, you could compare it to last year's return, and if there's a significant difference, and you're not aware of a significant difference that happened in your life, then that would definitely cause me to ask some questions. Is that individual padding the account, increasing something that doesn't exist? But if you haven't had some sort of financial windfall, there shouldn't be any difference from prior year to current year. So that would be a way to do it. Your good tax preparer is going to ask you a gazillion questions up front. They're going to want to see information documents, W-2, wage and tax statements, 1099s, other information. They're going to want to know about who you're claiming on the return, tax identification numbers for those individuals, and things of that nature. So if you go to a preparer and they don't want to see any documentation, turn around and walk out. Mm-hmm. That's not a good one.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you're responsible, right? The tax preparer should be able to sign it. They have to sign it, but you're responsible.
That is exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Let me turn over to Ron Marker. You investigate scams and bad goings on. In fact, I understand there's a list called the Dirty Dozen, and I think you're going to tell me a couple of things maybe at the top of that list to watch out for.
Right. Every year the IRS puts out their Dirty Dozen right around this time. These are just scams that we're warning the public to keep an eye out for. Especially during tax season. Chief among those this year is identity theft. This is basically crooks out there using a legitimate taxpayer's identity and personal information to file a tax return and claim a refund. And the taxpayer will find out about this when they go to file their return, and the IRS will tell them, well, there's already a return on file. We've already issued a refund. The taxpayer will then become aware that, hey, my identity may have been stolen. Someone's out there claiming refunds in my name. To this, the IRS has set up a specialized identity protection unit, and you can get more information on that at irs.gov/identity theft. It'll work you through the process of what you need to do when you think you've become a member of identity theft and someone is out there using your information to get returns processed.
So you can check?
Yes, you can check. Yeah. Like I said, some of the tip-offs are there might be a return out there that's already been filed in your name, or you might get some information back from the IRS asking that, you know, there were three W-2s filed with the IRS in your name when really you only had one job, and where are the other two coming from? Someone might be out there using your name to gain employment.
What if you've been victim of such a fraud? What's the remedy? What can you do?
Well, you should always contact your local police and file a report. You should always contact your credit card companies and things like that, your bank, and let them know that you may have been a victim of identity theft. And as far as the IRS process goes, you can go to the irs.gov website, and it'll give you complete instructions on what you need to do to get right with the IRS.
Mm-hmm. Another problem is phishing scams.
These are we see these year after year, and what these are, they're basically unsolicited emails or texts or other things, forwarding you to a fake website that asks you to input your personal information, your financial information, and what the crook will do is they'll use this information to either file a fake return in your name or just clear out your account, steal your identity, open credit cards in your name and whatnot, and basically ruin you financially. So what we do is we let people know that the IRS will never send you an unsolicited email, number one, and number two, the IRS will never ask you for your personal information, like your social security number, in an email. So if you get an email like this, we ask you that you forward it on to the IRS at our website, phishing, phishing, at irs.gov, and we'll take a look at that and hopefully shut it down in quick order.
And never, never, never give out sensitive information in response to an email that you for a person you don't know.
Absolutely. You should always ask yourself, why does this person need this information, and does this person really need this information?
Mm-hmm. Now, what if you've, I guess, not filed, done something wrong with your taxes? Maybe you're on the wrong side of the law here. You want to come clean.
Well, a lot of people don't know that the IRS has an ongoing voluntary disclosure program, both for income you've earned domestically and for money you may have hid offshore. And what you can do is, the key is prior to the IRS finding out about it. So as long as you're not under a criminal investigation or as long as you're not under some sort of audit, you can come into the IRS and say, hey, I know I haven't paid what I should have paid. I've hidden some money, or I haven't declared everything. And the IRS will work with you. And of course, you'll have to pay the complete tax in full, along with some penalties and interest. But by coming in most instances, you'll be able to avoid any type of criminal prosecution.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've seen a lot of commercials on television, companies which are touting their services. We can represent you to the IRS, and we can get you a lot better deal. And that it looks very attractive. But a lot of things are better than they seem. I wonder, are these companies legitimate?
Private industry in that area, Tom, some of them are legitimate. Most are. Some of them are not. And when we find out, we shut them down. But you, the individual taxpayer, have to make that decision. What I would offer to a taxpayer, to a Utahn, is contact the Internal Revenue Service and check on our fees. We're not going to charge you anything. Check on our payment arrangements and agreements and ease to work with. We're going to offer you, I think, the best deal in town. But having said that, you know, you have the right and the ability to go to these privately owned companies and seek assistance from them. But your federal government's been there. We know the rules. We're going to provide you the benefit as the rights associated with the taxpayer. and we're not going to charge you any money for it. Mm-hmm. So you can consider that.
Seems kind of strange for the IRS to be talking about this, that you can come, I haven't paid my taxes, I can come to the IRS and come clean. What generally would happen? Would I have penalties? Would I have problems?
Well, I think if you're talking about somebody that owes money and they're wanting to work with the Internal Revenue Service, that's not an issue. There's going to be interest that's going to be accruing and is required by law to be charged. But with Ron's area, if you have an individual that is willfully trying to defraud the federal government, that's a totally different story. Mm-hmm. But having talked initially about this, the Internal Revenue Service has a program called Fresh Start. And this is for individuals who currently owe money so that we will work with you in this area. And what it does is, currently, there's a new enhancement to this Fresh Start. And if you are unemployed for more than 30 days in 2011 or 2012, we can work with you so that you don't have an a late payment penalty. That's 0.5% of the amount that you owe. Now, it doesn't sound like a whole lot, but all those pennies do add up. So you're getting some relief here from the Internal Revenue Service if you've been out of work as an employee, or if you are a self-employed individual, an independent contractor, and you've seen a reduction of 25% or more in your business due to the current economy, you'll be eligible for that item. And we've also reduced the amount of paperwork required for an individual that owes around $50,000 or less. We've streamlined that payment arrangement. But in the past and currently and in the future, we will work with taxpayers who have a liability, tell them up front how they can avoid it in the future, and then work with them in a payment arrangement so that everything is taken care of within a couple of years or so, or even less.
Hmm. I'm still thinking about the
advertisement on TV?
Shopping around. So I really could come to the IRS and say, here's my problem.
Yes.
And then go shop to the other companies. And
you have the ability to deal directly because you are the taxpayer. If you want to seek assistance, such as someone that could represent you, that's fine too. And that individual will probably want a fee for their services. Mm-hmm. But you can deal directly with the Internal Revenue Service at any point in time. And that is an issue that I don't know if everybody's aware of or not, but as long as you talk with the Internal Revenue Service and keep those lines of communication open, we'll work with you in any area that you have. Some people, if you look at it the other way, hey, I don't know much about depreciation and I've got this property that I'm renting. How does that work? We can explain to you how those tax laws work, provide the forms and assistance in that area. Are we going to file the return for you? No. But we'll give you the information and education so that you can. And if you do happen to owe, we'll work with you in that area too.
Hmm. Now, you were telling me before we went on the air, there are some, 700 people in Utah who've not filed the 2008 return.
Few more than 700, 7,800.
7,800
Utahns who haven't filed for 2008. And the Internal Revenue Service has information provided to it primarily from the Social Security Administration, who gets the information from the employer or someone that would issue an information return. So we're seeing that these individuals, if they file, these 7,800 Utahns, would have a refund coming to them. And this is for the 2008 year. Then there's a statute of limitations that the law allows for an individual to claim an overpayment, a refund. And that statute is about to expire for the 2008 year. So these individuals that haven't filed for 2008 could file on or before Tuesday, April 17th and receive their money. And we're looking about $6.6 million to be left on the table with a median amount of around $600. So these individuals would need to file that return, and they can get that form off of IRS.gov, download it. We have prior year forms, or they can call us, and we can mail it to them in time, because there's still some time left. And we can also provide a transcript of information that was provided to us by these third parties, basically your W-2 wage and tax statement. So if you don't have the old W-2 from 2008 and you don't have the forms, the Internal Revenue Service can provide that information to you, and then you can file and get that refund. But if you go past that date, Tuesday, April 17th, midnight, then you're going to forgo the ability to claim that refund. It's going to go in the general fund.
Hmm. Finally, I think people are always wondering, how can I avoid an audit? What are some of the red flags that...
And the easiest way to avoid an audit, folks, is to electronically file your tax return, because it's so accurate, 99.5% or better accuracy rate. Your paper return has a error rate of about 13 to 15%. But when you choose to electronically file, you're going to reduce that error rate to less than 0.5%. And that's generally what's going to cause some sort of a question in a letter generated, a correspondence audit, to the taxpayer. And it could be just a simple math error. Well, if you file electronically, you're not going to have a math error. That software won't let you do that. It's going to make sure that you have all the attachments and schedules that are supposed to be with the return. It's going to make sure that you have all of the tax identification numbers, Social Security numbers, and ITINs that you need to show on the return. So it will give you that complete package. 48 hours after it's been submitted electronically, the Internal Revenue Service will notify you that we've received it and are processing it, or we've received it and there's a issue and you need to retransmit. And if you choose to have your refund directly deposited into your savings or checking account, that can be done in 21 days or less. And there's no issuance of a check, so that money, that check, could not be stolen or lost or returned as undeliverable. So you have accuracy, you have speed, you have security. And the processing cost for an electronically filed tax return is 17 cents, where if you choose the old-fashioned paper route, it costs the federal government $2.66. So you're saving the federal government money, which in turn saves your tax dollars. Here in Utah for this year, we expect 1.1 million Utahns to file. Of that, 974,500 will choose to electronically file. So there must be something to it.
Mm-hmm. How long do I have to keep my records?
3 years.
3 years.
Generally speaking, four years for a business.
All right.
But there are some records that you want to keep until you completely have that asset gone. Mm. So let's say that you're putting money in a pension fund. Keep those records from day one. Mm. If you're depreciating an asset, then you want to keep the records on that plus 4 years after you've disposed of that asset. And we have a publication online, as well as you can order it, and deals with record keeping, and it will outline facts for you. And it doesn't have to be the old-fashioned paper. You can have electronic recordation now. So we even are tweeting and have Facebook as well as YouTube. As a matter of fact, YouTube with the IRS, there's some great little snippets where you can see the visual, hear the audio, and you've got a lot of information presented in a minimum amount of time that can get you going on your way.
Very good. Let me get to have you reiterate a place to go for information. Ron Marker, where can I find the Dirty Dozen and some information on avoiding problems, scams and such?
Again, you can go to www.irs.gov. And for any of the programs we talked about today, you can just type in the keywords for voluntary disclosure. Just type in voluntary disclosure. If you're interested in the identity theft, you can go to irs.gov/identity theft, and it'll give you information on that.
Very good. Any other contact information we should know about?
Well, we've got a phone number, 1-800-829-1040, 1-800-829-1040, and we do speak Spanish, say habla español.
Okay, very good. And we've got a couple extra days this year to file.
To the 17th, yeah.
Yeah, very good. I've been talking with Bill Brunson, who is a spokesperson for the IRS. Thank you.
Thank you.
And also with Ron Marker, who's a special agent with the Criminal Division of IRS. Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Hear that? Know what that is? It's the sound of tacos, chili Colorado, and a nice hot shower. No, really. You see, things are a little different down here at Land's End. You never really know what to expect next. It was Saturday morning, and Kara and I had just finished our morning coffee. She ran a couple of loads of clothes through the washing machine and told me to wait just a couple of minutes for the water heater to kick in so I could have a nice hot shower. Well, a couple of minutes came and went, and no hot water. A couple more minutes came and went, and still no hot water. Yep, we were out of propane again. Now, this had happened before, so it wasn't really such a big deal. All it meant was that, well, I'd have to put off that nice hot shower and use the grill for our meals. Not much of a sacrifice, if you ask me. And the washer and dryer thing? Well, hey, it's Mexico. We don't wear much anyway, usually just a t-shirt, shorts, and flip-flops. No worries. We don't always have all the amenities that were at our fingertips when we were living in the States. There are days when it is almost impossible to deal with the internet, for example. But no worries. There's always something better to do than stare at a computer screen. The grocery store ran out of our favorite gringo pantry items? Again, no worries. We'll try something new that will probably taste better anyway. It's not that people care less here. On the contrary, they seem to care more, a lot more. They just have their priorities set differently. They work and work hard, but they understand that a person also needs time for family, friends, and those special moments of life, like a walk on the beach with your partner, or watching the moon rise over the ocean. They understand that life is not just about going to work, coming home, eating dinner, and plopping in front of the television. People actually talk to each other here. They don't just text message each other. They stop and chat, whether they bump into each other on the street or in one of the shops. It's part of the culture, a slowed-down, take-it-all-in lifestyle that not only allows you to stop and smell the roses, as they say, but encourages you to do so. It didn't take us long to learn just how spoiled people who live in the United States really are. They are so used to living within a super infrastructure where there is always plenty of power, plenty of fuel, plenty of everything, that they have forgotten, I think, the finer points of life and lack the appreciation they should have for their modern conveniences. I mean, seriously, what do you think would happen in your neighborhood if it ran out of natural gas for 36 hours, or, for some reason, the internet disappeared for a day? This is Ed Casilia for Utah Public Radio.
My name is Brittany. I live in Washington City. I listen to UPR so I can stay up to date on pretty much everything here in Utah and all over the world. My favorite weekend program is Car Talk. I just love the click and clack, the Tappa Brothers. I donate to UPR to do my part in helping my favorite radio station stay on the air. My life is better with UPR.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.
You are listening to Utah Public Radio. For information on events across the state, visit our community calendar online at upr.org. Expected high temperatures across the state today, 52 in Cedar City, 53 in Logan, 55 in Ogden, 58 in Vernal, and 66 degrees in Moab. In addition, most areas across the state will experience periods of precipitation. Coming up later on Utah Public Radio, performance today at 11 o'clock, exploring music at 1, and all things considered at 4. Be sure to follow Utah Public Radio on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and visit our website at upr.org. The time is 10 o'clock.